Fair warning, I'm sorry. I think we're good. Thanks, Ryan. The first order of business is approval of the minutes from March 30th. Representative Vogel, would you like to move those minutes?
I will.
Thank you. The minutes have been moved. Discussion on the minutes? Seeing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed, same sign. The minutes are approved. We're going to go in reverse order of what the agenda calls for today. These are three informational bills. And is Representative Barr in the room? Barr?
Barr.
Instead of Barcy? Well, okay, we won't go in reverse order then. What we'll do, Representative Whalen, is she, where did she go? Well, everybody has, like, left the room.
This is awkward.
All right, I'm sure they're just out in the hallway, but...
Oh, yeah.
I looked over and everybody was in their seat, and now...
Here's Regina.
Good. All right, we'll go with Representative Barr's bill first.
You guys are fast.
Thank you, Matt.
We do what we can, and sorry, we're going in reverse order of what was on the agenda today, so we thought we'd move in that fashion. Representative Barr, if you want to address the... Well, it's not really even a bill, right?
Right.
If you want to talk about the...
What do you call it? The amendment.
The A14. I guess the A14 that's before us, it's an amendment. And I believe you are planning to offer this on the floor today. Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
And if you want to give us a little bit of context about what your bill does and then how this relates to that, that'd be great. Representative Barr.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So this is in relation to House File 587, which was unclaimed assets, which is included in the jobs omnibus bill, which will be heard today on the floor. And when that bill basically is changing some of the requirements for the Department of Commerce in terms of what they need to do to work to get unclaimed assets back into the hands of the rightful owners. So during the course of the committee meetings around when I presented to Commerce and then again in Jobs, there was a lot of concern raised about the privacy of the data that's being collected and how this data is being used. So post-committee meetings and before submitting my amendment, I was working with the Department of Commerce to learn a little bit more about what do they collect and how do they keep the data and how long and so forth. So part of the challenges, and I did have... some constituents approached me on this, and there's been some representatives who have also approached me on this. What's happening is that for certain claims, excuse me, I had not turned my phone off. For certain claims, they request a complete trust document and a complete will. And for any of you who have ever looked at a trust document or will, you might know that there's a lot of personal data included, name, address, phone numbers, social security numbers, birth dates, extended family. So a lot of information in there that's being collected by the department. So I did have some handouts that I was going to route, but they're not ready yet. Some of that data is being kept permanently, and so what this amendment is doing is requesting that this data be treated not as public data, but as private data. So with that, I would be open to questions, Madam Chair.
Members, are there any questions regarding what this amendment does? Seeing none, is there anyone in the audience that wishes to testify on behalf of this amendment? For or against? Okay, seeing no one. Representative Barr, thank you for being here, and we will see you on the floor.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And I might note, too, that you are a freshman. I don't think you've been before this committee before.
I am so sorry. I will, when you have your next committee meeting, I didn't even think about that. I'm sorry.
That's okay. You know, we'll let it go this time. Representative Whalen?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think I might be able to help you out, Representative Barr.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Yeah. She's got your back. All right. Thank you. Representative Whalen? Good Good morning. And Representative Whelan, if you would like to go ahead and talk about House File 2573.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Thank you so much for the opportunity to present this bill. I'd like to begin by providing just some brief background. In 1998, Minnesota passed a law requiring data related to abortion to be collected and maintained by the Department of Health. Since that time, we've seen a lot of changes, and currently there's a gap in the reporting requirements on abortion, which leads to an incomplete picture of abortion in the state of Minnesota. Specifically, the gap concerns telemedicine abortions, which involves a physician in one clinic and the patient in another clinic. The bill before you seeks to address this gap in information in order to provide a more complete picture of abortion in the state of Minnesota. Notably, I think we all agree information is valuable in helping lawmakers make policy decisions, and as MDH states on their report, the data they provide are important both from a demographic and public health viewpoint. Data from reports of induced abortion provide unique information on the characteristics of women having induced abortions. Uniform annual data of such quality are nowhere else available. Medical and health information is provided to evaluate risks associated with induced abortion at various lengths of gestation and by the type of abortion procedure used. The bill simply adds a requirement to the current report on induced abortion, which you should all have a copy of. If you look to the form, it requires the facility code be reported, and this bill simply requires, and I will refer you to line 3.1 to 3.2, that if the abortion was performed via telemedicine, the facility code for the patient and the facility code for the physician are both reported. This language was discussed with the department last year, and I reached out to them again this year before the hearing. I believe they're here to answer questions. And members, before the hearing today, I also reviewed the audio from last year's hearing, and I just want to be very, very clear. According to current requirements in law, the commissioner must ensure that none of the information included in public reports can reasonably lead to the identification of an individual performing or receiving an abortion. I can repeat that. Privacy is protected, and to my knowledge, there has never been a case of a woman or a doctor being identified from this public data. So to that end, I would say the department has done a great job on this, and we should have no concerns. So I refer you to your packet, which also includes a copy of the statute, 145.4134. In closing, and again to be clear, this is just updating the current reporting form to provide a more complete picture of abortion in the state. This is an update to current reporting requirements. And, Madam Chair, I'll stand for any questions.
Thank you, Representative Whelan. Member questions?
Could we do? I'd like to hear some of the testimony, Madam Chair.
Okay.
And maybe ask questions after that.
Okay. Is there anyone in the audience wishing to testify for or against this bill? I believe I have Andrea Ledger is in the audience. Good morning. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Andrea Ledger. I'm the Executive Director of NARAL Pro-Choice Minnesota, and I'm here to testify in opposition to this bill. This legislation is unnecessary, and it discriminates against a particular type of medical procedure. The facts are that medication abortion is extremely safe, that providers are already subject to numerous reporting requirements, and that this bill would single out abortion for a granularity of reporting not required of any other telemedicine procedure. Medication abortion, which can be provided via telemedicine, has an over 99% safety record. The number of adverse events associated with the medication used for medical abortion is less, for example, than for such medications as Tylenol and Viagra. The Minnesota Department of Health 2016 report on induced abortions disclosed that one-third of women in Minnesota choose medication abortion. Telemedicine is a method by which physicians provide medication abortion and is just as safe as medication abortion accessed in the same location as the physician. A study of Iowa patients found that 600 women utilizing abortion via telemedicine had comparable clinical outcomes to those who saw a doctor in person. The American Congress of Obstetricians and Gynecologists opposes legislation that creates barriers between patients and physicians, including attempts to restrict medication abortion via telemedicine. Telemedicine is becoming more common practice in all of medicine. In fact, in just 2015, the Minnesota legislature, led by a bipartisan coalition, voted to expand telemedicine by requiring insurers to provide reimbursement parity for telemedicine consultations. The system of telemedicine is especially important for Americans who live in remote or rural areas and do not have access to a nearby doctor, or who need a specialist located across the country. Approximately one-fourth of Americans live in rural areas, while only 10% of physicians practice in these areas. 95% of Minnesota counties have no abortion provider. It's extremely difficult for some women to travel to a reproductive health clinic where they can access abortion services directly from a provider. No other telemedicine procedure has been singled out for this kind of additional reporting. The report on induced abortions in Minnesota is already a lengthy and comprehensive document, with the 2016 report of 2015 data coming in at 32 pages, and it includes demographic data of women seeking abortions, numbers by count of women seeking abortion, county of women seeking abortion, the type of procedure performed, the reason for abortion, and complication rates. In an atmosphere of heightened rhetoric against abortion providers, we should be hesitant to create additional reporting requirements that could lead to identification of both patients and their doctors. A 2015 ProPublica investigation determined that anti-abortion extremists see state-collected abortion data as a resource for targeting and harassing patients and providers. According to the investigation, quote, abortion opponents have become experts at accessing public records, such as recordings of 911 calls, autopsy reports, and documents from state health departments and medical boards, then publishing the information on their websites. The bill before you today does nothing to protect women's health. Instead, it lays the groundwork to create additional barriers for women. Thank you for your time today.
Thank you. Is there anyone else in the audience wishing to testify for or against this bill? Seeing no one, we will open it up for member questions. Well, first of all, I'll give Representative Whalen a chance to weigh in on anything, any of those statements. Or if you don't want to, that's fine, too. We could just go to member questions.
Well, I will, one point I'll just make, thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you to the testifier for their engagement on the issue. To the point that it is unnecessary or discriminates, and there are already many reporting requirements, this issue of telemedicine abortions in particular is clearly something that across the country has caused concern among other states because several states have actually banned it.
Thank you. Representative Howell, you are first on the list.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and I was going to ask the testifier, but I guess I'll ask Representative Whalen, is there anything in this change in reporting requirement that bans, from the testifier's comments, I would think that this is going to restrict those in rural areas that look for this procedure, that would restrict them in any way. Is there anything in here that restricts their access to this procedure?
Representative Whalen. Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Howe. No.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Whalen, is there any other procedure performed via telemedicine that you collect any of this data on? Any other?
Representative Whalen.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Hillstrom. Other telemedicine procedures are subject to certain reporting requirements.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So what do you collect about those procedures? Do you collect the doctor information and the patient code information, or what information do you collect about other telemedicine procedures?
Representative Whalen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative. I actually don't collect anything, but the department, I believe the Department of Health does, but they're here to answer questions. If you have further questions on that, I would refer to them.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You're just pointing out this particular procedure for additional data collection. It would be helpful to know how does this procedure compare to other data that's being collected on other telemedicine procedures. So if somebody can answer that question, that would certainly be helpful.
Does the Department of Health want to come forward? Somebody know the answer to that question?
Anybody know?
Mr. Pollack? Good morning. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed answering the question if you know the answer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dan Pollack, Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Health. Representative Hillstrom's question, I believe, was what other forms of telemedicine procedure data do we collect? And the answer is none. We don't We don't collect data on telemedicine procedures. If there were problems about another telemedicine procedure, that might go to the Board of Medical Practice or the Board of Nursing.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Representative Whalen, in light of that testimony, why have you specifically targeted only this particular form of telemedicine and not others?
Representative Whalen. Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Hillstrom. Forgive me for misspeaking. I just pulled out the statute on telemedicine services, and it says this is Subdivision 3, Minnesota Statute 256B.0625. Telemedicine law states that as a condition of payment, licensed health care providers must document each occurrence of a health service provided by telemedicine to medical assistants enrollee. So there might be a little bit of clarity that I need to provide just for the record to say that the statute does address telemedicine in regards to licensed health care providers, that they must document the occurrence of a health service provided by telemedicine, including the location of the originating site and the distant site. And regarding this procedure in particular, currently we have agreed as the state of Minnesota in 1998, actually it was a DFL-controlled legislature, that information on abortion is important for policymaking purposes and other reasons. And right now there's an incomplete picture of the abortion, induced abortion services in the state because of this gap. 1998 telemedicine was not a service that was provided, and now it is. And this is simply updating the current laws to provide a more complete picture.
Representative Hillstrom. Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, Representative Whalen, you're saying a more complete picture. Does that mean that if you pass this provision that you will have all of the information that you're looking for, or are you still looking for more that will not be in the statute?
Representative Whalen. Thank you, Representative Scott, or Chair Scott and Representative Hillstrom. I think it's important as policymakers to have as much information as we can when we're making decisions. And I think moving forward, I wouldn't want to say that this is all the data that I would ever think would be helpful or useful, but this absolutely will help us moving forward to have a more complete picture.
Representative Hillstrom. Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Whalen, I know that this is one of the issues that you would like to see stopped in the state of Minnesota. I know that, and I understand that. And we see across the country that people are using these data collections procedures in order to stop behavior. And normally this committee wants to keep folks from collecting or accessing or using any kinds of data. So it strikes me as I won't go there. It strikes me that this is the one issue area where you just seem to not be able to get enough.
Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, is there anyone else scheduled to testify on this, or are we just asking Representative Whalen on the firing line, and if anyone else can come down, they can. What's the story on that?
There's no one else signed up to testify.
Okay. All right, thanks, Madam Chair. Then I'll ask Representative Whalen. Representative Whalen, I heard you say that I think the testimony was that there was very little chance that any individual patients or providers could be identified using that data. Is that correct?
Representative Whalen. Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Lesh. That is correct. According to current statute, the commissioner is required to ensure that any data that could reasonably lead to the identification of an individual either receiving or performing an abortion not be made public.
Well,
Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Historically, those kinds of assurances haven't necessarily satisfied the concerns of this committee, nor would I say has it satisfied your caucus when we talk about firearms background checks, for example. I'm wondering if, with respect to the security of the data, would you be satisfied if we said, say, firearms background checks, we can be assured that no one would see the identity of the holders of those licenses or permits? Would that satisfy you that data was secure if you were to vote on that?
Representative Whalen. Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Lesh, just to make sure I understand the question correctly, if a commissioner was required to suppress data on firearm background checks so that individuals couldn't be identified, would that
satisfy me? Is that what you're asking?
Yeah. Madam Chair, Representative Whalen, yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Lesh. I would actually want to know, I think, historically, if the Commissioner of, would that be Public Safety, has been required to do that and how well they have done that, because the Commissioner, or at least the Department of Health in the state of Minnesota, has a fantastic track record on this specific issue. And to my knowledge, to date, there has never been a concern brought forward or an individual identified from this data. So I would think that maybe we should check with them to see how they do it and then go from there. But I would want to make sure that we have all the information we can.
Representative Lesh.
Okay. Well, Madam Chair, thank you, Representative Whalen. That was a good dodge. I'm impressed. And I mean that genuinely, because it's a tough question to answer, right? There's no question that when we're talking about data, you can satisfy some people and you can't. And usually whether or not you can satisfy them comes down to the politics of the subject matter of the data. And I think we all understand it's been danced around a little bit, but the reason you're bringing this bill here is because of abortion. And there's still a division in this legislature about whether or not people have the right to choose that or whether or not they should not in varying degrees. And I would just point out to you, this legislature has changed in attitudes about that over the years, too. You had stated that this was passed in 1998. I would point out that in 1998, that was the same year that this legislature passed the Defense of Marriage Act. Okay, gay people couldn't get married. And now it's legal in the state of Minnesota. Okay, so attitudes change a lot. I understand your passion over this issue, but there are those of us who do have legitimate concerns that because of the politics of this issue, folks could come after these people, whether they're providers or whether they're patients. That's a legitimate concern of mine. I understand your motivations, and I'm not going to argue with you about your motivations because I understand and I know where you're coming from, but I do think that the long-term security of the data should be of paramount importance just because of the way political attitudes change. So, no other questions. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Lesh. And I've just been informed that we need to speak louder into our mics. There's some technical difficulties going on here this morning, so I'll talk louder. So, Representative Carlson, if you want to speak loudly for the tape.
Please. I'll do my best. Oh, there, I don't think we have any mics at all, do we?
Oh, I don't know.
Okay, a little bit.
Testing.
Can you hear this?
I'll talk loud. Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Whalen, you're a strong supporter of data privacy rights. We heard that in your comments during Real ID. You spoke very eloquently in terms of protecting your constituents' privacy rights. I see a lot of potential for serious infringement on privacy rights within this bill that's being brought forward. Can you speak to how you can guarantee those protections of those privacy rights within this bill?
Representative Whalen. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative. I will just refer everyone again to a statute that is current law. The Commissioner shall ensure that none of the information included in the public reports can reasonably lead to an individual having performed or having had an abortion. This would not change that, and I'm confident in the department to continue to uphold current law as they have done so well for the past several years.
Representative Carlson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Whalen. So thank you for pointing that out in the statute. Yes, we can all see it's there. My concern is, though, with this inherent risk for what I see as something that is doing nothing in which to protect women's rights, it seems like a great risk based on the reading of that and what we're after here. So I just don't think that this is worth that risk in terms of putting those potential privacy rights at risk. And I thought that would be something that would cause you concern as well. But thank you for pointing that out.
Well, Representative Carlson, on this reporting form, currently they have to list the facility code and the physician reporting codes. So regardless of the type of abortion that it was, you could still the same privacy risks are there now, you could argue, because they still have to put the facility reporting code where the abortion is being performed, mm-hmm. and the physician code where the physician is. Mm-hmm. So I don't see this as changing that. You could still pinpoint it to, you know, the department still has the same obligation to protect people's privacy, even if there's one person in the county. Let's say there's only one person that's Asian in a county. That could be something that might identify them. That's where this piece of statute, where the department has to protect their identity, comes into play. Representative Carlson, I don't know if you have any. I'll give you a chance to respond.
Thank you. Yes, I reviewed the form as well. I think that these infringements upon data privacy should call all of that into question, whether or not even that is necessary. So, I would be pushing back in the opposite direction and saying that we're putting people at great risk with their very sensitive data with these types of requests. So, I think it calls into question whether or not even receiving this kind of information is even necessary.
Well, I don't know the history of this report and how long it's been around, but I'm guessing it's been around a long time, and that the Department of Health finds some value in having this information. And I think this goes also to protecting women's health. If one of the reasons they collect this data is to make sure that abortion is safe. Mm-hmm. And so I think there's value in that. In that data. Representative Smith.
Madam Chair, thank you. Could we have the department come down and testify as to the length of time that this report has been in existence?
Certainly. Mr. Pollack is the closest one to the chair. I don't know if he wants to answer the question. Thank you for being here. And please introduce yourself for the tape and proceed with the testimony.
I'm Carol Hitchcheck. I've managed the collection of the data, and I produce the annual abortion report to the legislature.
Okay, and Representative Smith, did you want to ask the question?
Yeah, Madam Chair, thank you, testifier. How long has this report of induced abortion that was handed out, has this been in existence to your knowledge?
The data was first collected on that form starting in October of 1998. So the first published report covered those last few months of 1998 and all of 1999. So it has been an annual report since that time.
Thank you. Representative Smith?
Madam Chair, thank you. In addition, how many breaches of data security has there been reported to your knowledge since October of 1998?
There have been none.
Thank you.
Representative Smith, thank you. Any other member questions? Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I thought in the testimony that we heard, not from the Health Department, but I misunderstood, but I thought she said that one-third of abortions were from telemedicine. Was that no? Maybe you could testify as to how many you think are via telemedicine and how many abortions we're missing in this report right now, or maybe Representative Whalen knows that answer.
Representative Whalen?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative O'Neill. I believe it was medicinal abortions, which are what a telemedicine abortion would be. So it's not that one-third of abortions in the state of Minnesota are telemedicine, but that they are performed with medicinal, with drugs, and those drugs can be used in a telemedicine abortion, if that answers the question.
Representative O'Neill?
Thank you, Madam Chair. So there's a potential that we could be missing one-third of all the abortions if we don't change this. That's the potential is there. Or right now, we're definitely missing a whole lot. But.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative O'Neill. I don't believe so, but I can defer to the department on that. I will say I believe that right now the method of abortion is reported. So in the report there's a table that shows the methods, including non-surgical or medicinal. And within that's where you would have telemedicine abortions show up. So all of those I would hope are being reported, and then we would just want to know which ones are being done via webcam or telemedicine.
Okay, thank you. To the testifier from the department, do you happen to know the answer to that? Otherwise, we can bring up a previous testifier.
To the best of our knowledge, all abortions that are performed in Minnesota are reported to us. The piece of information that you're referring to that's missing, we do not collect information on whether the physician and the patient are at the same location.
Thank you. Thank you. Representative O'Neill, any follow-ups? Okay, thank you. I have a question for the Andrea Ledger. Thank you for being here. Ms. Ledger, did you testify that in Iowa they have a count on how many abortions are performed by telemedicine?
No. Madam Chair, to clear up the confusion, the count that I reported was that one-third of abortions in Minnesota are performed via medication abortion, non-surgical, as the department just testified. And that method is the method that would be used in telemedicine. The only issue would be where the doctor and the patient are located, and that's where the telemedicine angle comes in. The information about Iowa was from an Iowa study, and let me look back at my notes. Excuse me. An Iowa study of patients found that 600 women there who utilized abortion via telemedicine had comparable clinical outcomes to those who saw the doctor in person.
So there was information collected in the state of Iowa that 600 abortions were done via telemedicine. That's what you just stated. Is that correct?
In the state of Iowa, it was a study. It was a clinical study. So I imagine that, like with any other clinical study, that patients opted into that study for the data collection piece.
Okay. Well, I think, you know, it's Iowa saw it as a valuable piece of information to have. I don't see why Minnesota should be any different. Thank you for your testimony. Are there any other member questions? Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't know if Ms. Ledger knows the answer to this question, but did they identify the doctor and the patient code in the information that they collected, or was there any reason why the state would have had that information in the study? Because, members, that's what we're talking about here. Should government collect the doctor code and the location code and disclose to the public information about your constituents? And as folks on this committee who don't like it when government collects data about their citizens, I find this interesting. So does the government in Iowa collect this data about the people who are performing?
Ms. Ledger.
Madam Chair, Representative Hillstrom, I am not familiar with what the Iowa state statute requires in terms of reporting. I can say that for the information collected in this study, it was a clinical study that patients opted into. So they chose to disclose that information to the researchers who were performing the study.
Thank you. Representative Hillstrom, do you consider abortion women's health?
Madam Chair, I believe that things that happen between doctors and patients are between the doctor and the patient. And Madam Chair, I have known you for a long time to not want to disclose what happens between doctors and patients, except in this case. And so, Madam Chair, I believe that we need to protect women's access to all forms of health care. We are not here regulating or saying anytime a male has a vasectomy or anytime a male gets Viagra that they should be placed in a database. And that's what you're saying here, Madam Chair. When a woman receives a particular type of health care, she should be placed in a state database. When a doctor performs a particular type of health care, he should be placed in a state database. That's what you're doing.
So then you'd be okay if we just didn't have this form? No, these records were kept.
Madam Chair, I have long since supported people's right to their data privacy in their health care. And it's interesting that we're having this conversation even because I actually want to access prescription monitoring, which we already collect. And, Madam Chair, you wouldn't even give Representative Baker's bill a hearing, and so we're going to be offering that as amendment on the floor today. So it's okay to collect all of this data and disclose it to the public with related to this particular kind of procedure, but it's not okay when it comes to even prescription pills for opioid addiction.
And I would argue that the Department of Health keeps a lot of data that many of us disagree with. You're absolutely right. And so the newborn screening is one of those. And so I'm sure that if we offered a bill on that, that everyone would agree that they shouldn't be collecting that data.
But they should collect this.
Well, I'm just saying there's inconsistencies throughout law. And it's an important issue. Representative Whalen, I'll give you the last word.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, members and testifiers, for your engagement on this topic. I just want to clarify one more time that current statute does require that any data that could reasonably lead to the identification of an individual performing or receiving an abortion not be made public, as there have been a few insinuations that this could be leaked and made public, and that is not at all what this bill does, nor what it is seeking to do. Furthermore, based on some of the comments that were made regarding why we do different reporting requirements for this specific procedure versus other procedures, as has also been either stated or at least alluded to, there is a difference regarding the abortion procedure in the minds of many. Not necessarily everyone in this room, but in the minds of many, including myself and my constituents, that it's not like a vasectomy where it's a man and one individual. It's a woman and another individual, which could be a man or a woman, a baby. And so this is different, and it is important that we collect this information so that we as policymakers have all of the information we can to make the best decisions possible. Thank you for hearing the bill today, Madam Chair and members.
Thank you, Representative Whalen. Representative Lucero, you're up next.
Well, because they're already in the they're already in the omnibus bills.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee.
Senator Lucero.
I want to come before you today and speak about House File 1507, Madam Chair.
Please proceed.
So, Madam Chair, 1507 has to do with student data privacy, and I'm very proud that this topic is a broadly bipartisan topic. It concerns many different stakeholders, and it is one that there's been a lot of support for. So what I want to do is just give an introduction here. I have a PowerPoint presentation to bring some background and then go over the bill, and then I have some testifiers after that. So, Madam Chair, I'll start with the presentation.
Sounds good.
So student data privacy has two goals in mind, and it is to protect student private data as well as ensure parental authority over their children's private data. So, by way of background, current Minnesota state statute has Chapter 125B, and it's titled Education and Technology. And in fact, I have it right here. The number of pages is only 5 in length. It is very slim, as you can see. It dates back to 1980. There are a couple sections in it. One section is contracts for computers and equipment in schools. That section has not been updated since the year 2000. The section NDE department duties has not been updated since 2003. The section titled Internet Access for Students has not been, for all intents and purposes, updated since 2007. Now, in 2015, there was just a minor change, an insignificant change. The definition of a charter school pointer was changed. So aside from that, it hasn't changed since 2007. So with that, the topic of technology and students, for all intents and purposes, it's been at least a decade since there's been any changes, and that's a lot of time. But during that same amount of time, innovations in technology, as we're all well aware, have exponentially created a plethora of new technology capabilities. Positive benefits from these new capabilities are indeed many, one of them being the use of technology in the classroom better prepares students to be more competitive in the global workforce. It allows, technology has allowed for an increase of efficiencies and a decrease of costs for our schools to better use limited resources. And there are many other benefits to the innovations that have occurred within the technology space and using those technologies in the academic and education context. But the problem is, with those innovations and increased capabilities in technology, there is much alarm among parents. And that's big data. So what big data is, it's the mass collection and aggregation of student information. And you can see that by the graphic there in the lower right-hand corner, there are multiple pieces of information that are all collected and then aggregated together. Multiple sources into a single source. Big data then, after collection, is stored and data warehoused. Once it's collected and stored, that allows for data correlation and data mining. These multiple data points can be data mined. And we're familiar with data mining in this committee for sure. Data mining allows for the establishment of patterns. It allows for the building of profiles on students. It harvests intelligent, actionable information that can be used by the audience or whoever, whatever the purpose is. In other words, big data is the intersection of information, analytics, and human behavior. Sharing the student private data with third parties is a huge concern because after it's collected, stored, data mined, and profiles built, that data can be shared with third parties, and that is what is happening today.
Madam Chair.
So,
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Representative Lucero, is it only happening in the education area, or is all government data big data based on your slideshow presentation?
Lucero. Madam Chair and Representative Hillstrom, big data is a problem amongst all government and the private sector. Data collection and data mining is occurring across departments and across private sector, and it's a huge concern, absolutely.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
I wonder, Representative Hillstrom, if the Department of Health sells the data that they receive to other parties, to third parties, if that's what you're getting at.
Madam Chair, it doesn't have to be sold if it's public information.
Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And so last year, last session, I was a member of the Education Policy Committee. This year, I'm not. But last year, we had an informational session in which the department, MDE, Minnesota Department of Education, came down, and they testified amongst the regarding the data that's being collected on our students that the department has within their possession. They receive 30 to 40 applications per year from third parties requesting that our students' private data is shared out. So in that hearing, I asked the question, so of the third parties that you're sharing with, how many times have you audited their technology systems to ensure that the data is properly being protected? And their answer was, it has been at least a decade. And that's a huge concern. Because the technology systems where, let's just take it for granted, that the technology systems and the controls in place for our students' private data in the department are sound. Once that data is transferred to a third party on a third party's technology system, those controls cannot be validated. And if there's a breach, the controls and processes may not be in place for proper notification and proper protection. So it is a common industry best practice to audit the technology systems of those third parties by which third-party data is shared. But again, the department testified that that hasn't happened in at least a decade with our students' data. So big data is big money. And Representative Hillstrom just asked the question, is this happening widespread? Absolutely. Because it is a billion-dollar industry. Collecting massive amounts of information and data mining it for purposes of building profiles on us that third parties can use for actionable information is, as these graphics show, a big industry. So a couple headlines here, ripped from the headlines regarding data mining. How companies now know everything about you, every detail of your life, what you buy, where you go, whom you love, etc. The volume and diversity of data being captured by companies today is staggering. Using techniques ranging from supermarket loyalty cards to targeted advertising on Facebook, private companies systematically collect very personal information from who you are, what you do, what you buy, and so on. So data mining examples here, one of my favorites is the Target. For those who haven't seen this, this dates back to 2013, if you haven't seen this headline. So there was a father who had a daughter in high school who they began to receive coupons in the mail from Target. And reading the article here, in response to receiving those coupons, a man, the father, walked into Target outside Minneapolis demanding to see the store manager. The father was angry over coupons for baby clothes and cribs that had been sent to his daughter, who was still in high school. How dare Target encourage teen pregnancy, he ranted. The manager apologized, and the father went home. Then the manager called a few days later to apologize again. On the phone, however, the father said he had had a talk with his daughter, and it turned out she was pregnant, and the father apologized to the manager. How did Target know this? It's based on the profiling that they do, based on consumer habits, probably from a Target loyalty card or one of the cards they have. They track the consumer purchases. And through data mining, it's been determined that a woman, when she's become pregnant, her consumer habits change in what she purchases and the quantities thereof. And they have, down to a science, been able to determine when that's the case, and they begin to send out proactively these coupons. That's just one example of the power of data mining. Also last year in education policy, this is very concerning. This is MnLink. If you haven't heard of MnLink, it's a centralized database. I took this screenshot right off of the University of Minnesota's website. And down at the bottom there, you can see, supported by the National Science Foundation. You see in the center there, that is an integrated database. And there are multiple databases around it that are feeding the MnLink integrated database. And you can see that on the top, there are four education-related databases that NDE is feeding into it, which includes academic data records, or student academic records, academic disciplinary records, standardized test records database, the MCAs, and Education Minnesota testing records. So combining that with other department data. So from Department of Human Services, you have child protection records that are being fed in, children's mental health records that are being fed in to MnLink. Medicaid claims. From the Department of Corrections, there are records of incarcerated adults being fed in. Juvenile court records, and so on. The question was asked of MDE when they were in front of that policy, and they admitted that the data was not being sanitized, meaning it could be determined which individuals from the department, at least, the data belonged to. So sanitizing data means stripping the individual's name but providing the rest so that the rest of the data might be valuable for research purposes, but there isn't a need to link that to an individual. But in this case, that wasn't happening because whatever the University of Minnesota, the National Science Foundation, and others, whatever research they're doing with this MnLink database, they want individuals' names. And can you see here how a profile can be created? Based on their academic history, and then once they become adults, link that up with corrections, etc. Where is that data going? Who is it being shared with? How is it being destroyed? Very spooky stuff. Very alarming. So with data that's been collected that exists on technology systems, there are definitely concerns for data breaches. But data breaches come in two forms. The first form is those gaining access who are not authorized. That's the most common form that most people are familiar with, called hacking, for example. So obtaining access to data not authorized to access. But the second type of data breach is very important as well, and that is those who do have authorized access abusing the access that they have. So I have a few examples here from Minnesota government data breaches of both types. Here in January of 2013, 5,000 alerted of records breach and abuse of driver's data by a DNR employee. In February of 2014, KMSP anchor lawsuit claims cops snooping on her license. Another one ripped from the headlines, August of 2015, driver's license data of 18 individuals accessed. This one is February of 2013, new lawsuit over data breach of driver's license data joins ever-growing list. This one is from April of 2015, Metropolitan State University, 160,000 student records were breached. This one is MNsure, an in-house flaw, faulted an MNsure data breach. 1,600 Social Security numbers were breached. By the way, when this breach happened, this was at the advent of MNsure, a brand new technology system that was being stood up. Not a legacy system, but a brand new technology system. Presumably, they'd be introducing new technology and best practices, etc. And even with that, there was still the breach. This one is from February 2013. Audit finds common misuse of drivers, Minnesota driver data. So the solution, which is what this bill seeks to do, is to put controls in place to protect student private data, to ensure parental authority over their children's private data. This bill is not intended to prevent schools from engaging in day-to-day operations. The bill is not intended to prevent teachers from teaching students, not to limit the use of technology in the classroom. The bill is not intended to prevent schools from having rosters or brochures printed for sports events. It's not intended to prevent yearbooks from being printed and distributed. It's not intended to prevent photography services, the ordering of class rings, etc. Regulatory compliance and having controls in place is not new to the technology space. So it's been well established of the necessity to establish controls to protect private data. And so I have a couple examples here. Sarbanes-Oxley. Sarbanes-Oxley was the product of the Enron Arthur Andersen scandal back in the early 2000s. There was a need, a recognized need to control data. So Sarbanes-Oxley applies to U.S.-based publicly traded companies. Gramm-Leach-Bliley Act, GLBA, that is it's a similar type of protection of data integrity applying to financial institutions. HIPAA and high tech, similar data controls applying to the health organizations. And then there's the payment card industry, PCI, that is for merchants, and those are similar standards that apply to the handling of data, sensitive data, in the that has to do with credit cards. So, concluding here, the law protecting student privacy data is long out of date, not only in Minnesota, but across the nation. This is a very complex issue because technology in the schools touches many other areas, but this issue is extremely important, and the time to act is right now. And I fully recognize and acknowledge the language before us is not perfect. And that's why I look forward to working with all stakeholders to improve upon and create the strongest possible language to accomplish our intent of protecting student private data and ensuring parental authority. So an overview of the bill, Madam Chair and committee. So Section 3, that is taking definitions, standardizing definitions from multiple areas of the statutes and trying to create a common definition set. Section 4 specifies requirements for student information system contracts between schools and vendors, because right now it's an unregulated space. The details of the contracts is something that needs to be addressed. Opt-in agreements required for the collection of data and sharing with third parties. Clarifies who has who is authorized to access data, school employees, parents, etc. Section 4 also requirements to delete the data, and also includes directory information being permitted. Section 5 has to do with one-to-one technology being regulated. And that is such as iPads or other technology or software that is linked one-to-one. So a student logging in to a particular application or a student using a particular hardware asset, where the actions thereof could be linked to that student. So that's Section 5 addresses. Technology assigned or authenticated to a single individual. Section 6 deals with limitations on the use of evidence obtained in violation of these sections is inadmissible in civil or criminal proceedings. Section 7 is annual training required for the protection of data. And there are, again, I understand there are other sections, but that's the highlight there of most of the bill itself. And with that, Madam Chair, I do have some testifiers that I'd like to call forward.
All right. Okay. Representative Lucero, if you want to have your first testifier come forward, that'd
perfect.
Be great.
You can all come up.
Good morning. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Hi, my name is Chris Daniels. Thank you, Madam Chair and committee. My name is Chris Daniels. I'm a board member of Minnesota Advocates and Champions for Children. As a concerned parent, not just on behalf of my children, but of all children of our state, I appreciate letting myself and Max speak today. Well over 140-10. With all the attention given to the data and data breaches that occur in our quickly advancing society, these numbers should frighten you. Target, Cub Foods, Super Value, J.P. Morgan Chase, Home Depot, Neiman Marcus, White Lodging Services, Sally Beauty, Michaels, 11 Brand Casinos, P.F. Chang's, UPS, Dairy Queen, Goodwill, Jimmy John's, Kmart, Staples, Bebe, Sony, Jewel Osco are just some of the names of the major data breaches that have occurred in the last 4 years. Everyone with an electronic form of payment in their wallet or purse knows a sense of dread that overcomes them when a data breach is reported. What will that mean for their next week, month, or year? The hassle of getting a card? Will my identity be stolen? Will somebody destroy my credit? Yet the numbers 40 and 10 should matter more. However, they have seemed to slip through the cracks. 40 is the number of entities that the MDE shares the data of our children. 10 is the number of years that have gone by without an audit to check for a breach, as evidenced by the testimony given last year by the MDE. Simply put, Minnesota parents don't know who their children's data has been shared with or if it has been lost to cyberspace and nefarious characters. According to a 2016 report from Identity Theft Resource Center and Cyber Scout, major data breaches increased by 40% in 2016. In 2017, the Identity Theft Resource Center reports that through March 21st, there have already been 353 breaches. This represents a 56% increase over just 2 years ago. Obviously, we have a society that's seeing technology advancing at a rate that history has never seen. From testing, surveys, and one-to-one learning, our children are inundated with data mining technology that didn't exist 5 years ago and that many people couldn't even imagine just 10 years ago. However, protections to help counter the dangers of this digital exposure have not been addressed. Our children's data privacy, financial future, and basic innocence need to be protected. There are far too many stories of a stolen future that exist. It is time for the protections of our children in this electronic world to be addressed and updated. This bill will help address concerns that all parents have about the future of their children and helps protect the innocence that all children should have. This is truly a subject that should not be partisan. Our children are not partisan. They are our future, and our future needs to be protected. Thank you.
Thank you. Next testifier. Good morning,
Madam Chair and Representatives. My name is Kristen Schultz. I am a parent and citizen lobbyist for Minnesota Advocates and Champions for Children. HF 1507 will not change the way school districts can use technology. It will not restrict the teachers in their use of testing or online curriculum. This bill is about how the collected data is handled. Another area of this bill that I fully support is the necessities for teachers to understand more about how to handle the student data concerning third parties. The last section of this bill implements timely training for all teachers, staff, IT directors, and other individuals who access student data regarding FERPA, which is the Family Education Rights and Privacy Act, in order to prevent unauthorized access or disclosure of student data. additional training would either be annual or as need arises. With data being collected through programs like Class Dojo, TIES, Infinite Campus, along with testing, survey, online curriculum, and apps, this is why training on FERPA is so important. With privacy being so valued, it is imperative that teachers receive this training to help protect our children's data. No teacher or administrator intends to put our children's data at risk. Unfortunately, with the mind-numbing pace of changes happening in this arena, time to examine the effects and possibilities has not taken place. Teachers are closest to the students in the educational setting, and it is important that they have this opportunity to understand more about student data. The burden of developing this training would not be on districts or MDE, as the U.S. Department of Education and Family Compliance Policy Office provides forms, best practices, and visual training. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for your testimony. Good morning. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Madam Chair, committee members, good morning. I'm Linda Bell, and I'm here on behalf of Minnesota Advocates and Champions for Children and our over 5,000 members who routinely question the use of children's data without their parental consent. My role with MAC is primarily working with parents across our state, answering their questions, and trying to help empower them to better go back and work with their schools and on issues like data privacy. So thank you for hearing my testimony. Based upon our research and for many others' personal experience, we know that when students log into their computers using their personal SSID login, their data flies instantaneously to a number of different entities. This handout, which you might have, shows an individual student's single data stream within our own state and just happens to include some of the governmental data collection. Let me create a picture for you. Where does the data go? It goes to school district warehouses, state and federal government agencies, including 40-plus contracts maintained by the MDE and 150-plus contracts maintained by the U.S. DOE. It goes to the MARS system. It goes to the MDE-approved vendors like TIES and Infinite Campus. It goes to survey companies and or recipient third parties, testing companies, online curriculum companies, applications, apps, universities, research entities, the state longitudinal data system, nonprofits, the MinLink data system that Representative Lucero spoke about at the University of Minnesota, and third parties of all kinds, including Google, eScholar, Interactive Health Technologies, Khan Academy, Newton, LearnBoost, LearnSprout, Moodle, and Noodle, and literally thousands of educational technology companies and products. This is a simple single stream of data here, but when third parties are included, we can multiply the number of streams many, many times over. When our state students log on to their computers, we can liken this action to the clicking on of a fountain with multiple streams of water flowing all at the same time. This is our children's data being released. Many of our parents ask, how can school districts keep track of where personal student information is going and whether it is being shared by entities who are supposed to safeguard and keep our children's data secure? Once student and family data is out there on the open market, it is sold and resold over and over again. My family has experienced this firsthand with a breach from a school district. So just a couple of quick facts. We know that in 2013, the College Board and ACT was sued for selling PII, personally identifiable information. In 2014, the SAT was included in that litigation. In 2013, UC Berkeley students sued Google over privacy invasion. In 2014, parents sued Google over their apps for education, whereby Google scanned contents of email messages, which allegedly violates federal and state wiretap laws. And most recently, in January 2017, the Mississippi State Attorney sues Google over online tracking of students in his state, violating the state consumer protection laws. To give you an idea, total advertising revenues made up 91% of Google's $55.5 billion profits in the year 2013. And that's when online learning really got started. That's 4 years ago. I hasten to note what it might be now. But this is a significant percentage of which is likely to be derived from the 30 million students who number among the 425 million users worldwide. How interesting is it that Google is offering these educational products? To restate, how concerned is Google that our nation's students are being highly educated? Clearly, Google has been sued numerous times, promises to stop data mining and selling student PII, but then continues on their way. How do these companies get away with sharing and selling student PII? Many times, it's in the contracts with the schools. For example, Khan Academy, based in California and previously known for its really outstanding math curriculum. Khan provides free web-based tutorial services in exchange for the user's data. It's in the contract. They get the academic progress, the internet browsing habits of students, among other personal information that students put online. Our state's children are having their personal habits and academic pursuits, their very identities, stolen, shared, and sold. HF-1507 will bring some much-needed protections to students and families. Very simply, by helping schools implement best practices in handling data. The fourth section in the bill, titled Student Information Systems, provides specific requirements that must be in a contract with a school and a software provider related to the security of the student data that's transmitted or collected, and requires that the contracts include provisions identifying who owns the data, how to handle a data breach, how and when data must be destroyed, how and when data can be accessed, and prohibitions to the sale of data. That's important. And so MAC heartily endorses HF-1507 and seeks your serious consideration.
Thank you for your testimony. Representative Lucero, do you have any other testifiers?
I do have one more. Ben Feist from the... Oh, there he is.
Okay. And then after him, Margaret Weston from Osseo School District. Good morning. Please state your name for the record and go on with your testimony.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Ben Feist. I'm the Legislative Director for the ACLU of Minnesota. Thank you for taking the time to hear this important bill this morning, and thank you to Representative Lucero for his work over the past several years. During these last several years, there has been a growing bipartisan consensus that we need to empower Minnesotans to take control of their privacy and bring our digital privacy laws into the 21st century. It makes a lot of sense that we're looking at this on the state level and that other states are doing this as well. As we're all aware, the federal government moves incredibly slow on these issues, if at all. And in terms of internet privacy, it appears that we're moving backwards, unfortunately. Today, governments and corporations are armed with powerful tools that enable them to get at our personal information without our knowledge or consent. The risk these tools present to Americans' privacy is made far worse by the fact that our privacy laws have failed to keep pace with the new technologies. Corporations should only be able to access our personal data or our children's data if we have given them clear and explicit permission to do so. The same rule applies to the government. The government should not be allowed to obtain this information without either your permission or a warrant issued by a judge. Using stealthy, secret, or concealed technologies to get your data without your knowledge and consent is not acceptable, and we need stronger laws to prevent it from happening and to punish those who do it. This is especially the case when it comes to protecting the privacy of Minnesota's children. By introducing this legislation, Representative Lucero has recognized that our laws should empower parents and children to decide who they want to share personal and private information with. Despite the sensitivity of the information, limitations on access to and use of this information by third parties and school officials are frequently weak or non-existent, which means private corporations and law enforcement often have easy access to detailed information about our children without their parents ever knowing about it. This act retains the benefits of these important technologies to advance our school's educational goals while empowering parents and students to reasonably restrict who has access to their personal information. The bill first addresses student information systems. Information that used to be stored in a file cabinet in the principal's office is now being uploaded onto remote third-party servers, sometimes even in real time. Despite the sensitivity of this information, which includes students' grades, social security numbers, disability status, and information on whether they have been disciplined, received remedial help, or qualify for free lunch, few limitations exist on how third parties can get access and use of the data stored, and those rules that do exist are far too easy to circumvent. This is especially troubling because some of that information, if it were to become publicly available or end up in the wrong hands, could prove very damaging to a student. This bill prevents student information system providers from accessing and sharing personal student data on their systems unless doing so is for a specific educational purpose that benefits the student, the school, or the educational system, or where they have sought and received limited and specific permission from the student and or the student's parents. The student data is highly valuable and easily monetized as a resource, and we need to protect our kids from companies who are taking advantage of their relationship with educational institutions in order to get access to it. Second, the bill addresses one-to-one programs. I think it's important to note that since its original version, this bill has been stripped down. It's still fairly long, but it really only deals with these two specific technologies that we're talking about today. An increasing number of schools today participate in this one-to-one technology program where a third party provides free laptops or tablet computers such as iPads for the school year. While these programs are highly beneficial, they also enable third-party device providers and school officials to track and monitor everything a student does with the device without the children's parents ever knowing about it. This includes what websites a child visits, what information they read online, what the contents of their emails say, and in extreme cases, even includes remote activation device webcams. That's happened in other jurisdictions, and it's been highly troubling to those involved. The challenge with one-to-one programs is that device providers frequently use the devices to obtain personal information about students who use them and to build a commercial record on those students, whether the students want to be monitored or not. Students should not have to choose between having access to important technology and preserving their privacy. Telling students they can choose to protect their privacy by not accepting the one-to-one device is a false choice, because such an option essentially tells students they can either protect their privacy by declining the device and be at an educational disadvantage compared to other students, or give up their privacy, get the device, and improve the quality of their education. This is an unfair choice to ask students to make, and it should be prohibited. No one wants Minnesota schools to become a place where only students with financial means to purchase their own laptop or a tablet computer can afford to keep their privacy and get a top-notch education. This bill is designed to retain the benefits of one-to-one device programs while empowering parents and students, free of any coercion, to reasonably restrict who has access to the device and the sensitive and personal information that may be on it. Device providers may still secure benefits from providing the devices, such as gaining early brand loyalty from students, as long as they do not infringe on student privacy. We look forward to continue to work on this issue as the bill moves forward. And again, I'm happy to take any questions at this time.
Thank you, Mr. Feist. We have one other testifier, and then please stick around in case others have questions for you. Ms. Weston, Margaret Weston. Good morning. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Good morning, Madam Chair. My name is Margaret Weston. Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to comment about the proposed legislation concerning student information systems. I'm here today as the General Counsel for the Osseo Area Schools, Independent School District Number 279.
Excuse me, Ms. Weston, could you speak up a little bit? We're having problems with the mics this morning. Thank you.
So I'm the General Counsel for the Osseo Area Schools, School District Number 279. Osseo Area Schools serves over 20,000 students and is the fifth largest school district in the state of Minnesota. We have over 25 school or program sites in the district. House File 1507 has been changed considerably since the last draft and is much more consistent with other laws governing the operations of schools, and for that I congratulate Representative Lucero. but still contain some inconsistencies with current law regulating searches of district-owned property and other reasonable suspicion searches by school district personnel. I'm not going to comment on those issues. We'll be working to iron out those differences over the summer, I believe. But the point I would like to make with my testimony today, however, is the negative impact that students' educational experience that I believe can follow the requirement that students and parents opt into an electronic record-keeping system used by their schools rather than allowing an opt-out system. Schools in Minnesota use electronic record systems for attendance, grades, discipline records, health plans, class schedules, parent-family emergency contact information, IEPs, and 504 plans. I am not aware of school districts that collect social security numbers on those student information systems, but they do use the systems for operating the school systems. The electronic systems are designed to allow access to the records based on the job requirements of the employees. In other words, a teacher has access to information about that teacher's students, but not information about other students. An attendance clerk has authorized access to attendance information, but not to student grades. And those can be regulated by the password logon for the individual employees, which can be changed to keep up with changing personnel and student information. We're also required by law to file electronic reports of student test scores, behavior, and other aspects of student life to the Minnesota Department of Education. It is the OSSEO area schools' experience that when parents are required to opt into a program or opportunity such as a field trip, we can expect hundreds of families not to opt in to even an individual school, and that is through oversight, the loss of the permission form. Parents are not able to find it, they've lost it, and that would not be, that is only through inadvertence or when there's a desire to participate and the parents just don't get around to signing in the opt-in. I would assume that for this particular type of service, there would be people who would choose not to opt in, as well as the hundreds of families who, through carelessness or lack of communication or their chaotic lifestyles, we have, you know, obviously homeless students, we have students who are highly mobile, they would not be able to locate the appropriate form and get it to the right place at the right time. So in a system of 20,000 students, we would have probably two or more students in each classroom who have not opted into the program, such as the electronic attendance, electronic grades, and class scheduling. Those records would have to be maintained in a separate paper system for those students. Maintaining separate paper files for this large number of students would be particularly disruptive in our middle schools and high schools. Class schedules are prepared electronically based on each student's requests and the space available. With both an electronic and a paper system involving a large number of students, the schedules could not be finalized until both the students in the electronic system and the paper system have been included. Operating the dual system would predictably delay finalization of class schedules and increase chances for errors. Electives may not be offered if there are not enough students who have expressed an interest in a class, causing uncertainty for both students and staff until the schedule can be finalized. In a high school with nearly 3,000 students, such as our Maple Grove Senior High, there would predictably be well over 100 students who would have been assigned classes separately using the paper system. Coordinating the two systems is inherently more likely to lead to delays and mistakes in course assignments, causing disruptions for students who need specific courses to meet their needs to fulfill their dreams. Protecting paper files under lock and key rather than through encryption and password protection can also have a negative impact on a student's experience in the case of a health or safety emergency. For instance, access to a student's health plan or emergency contact information can be made immediately by an employee with access to the electronic system. Locating the key to the correct filing cabinet and locating the paper file in the cabinet provides many opportunities for delay. The use of a separate paper system would also cause delays for students who change schools within the OSSEO school district. Our schools are best able to serve our students if they have immediate access by the appropriate individuals to a student's health plans, 504 plans, behavior plans, or IEPs, rather than waiting for paper files to arrive. Finally, paper systems are often less secure than electronic systems that have encrypted password-protected access. Paper records are not encrypted and password-protected, so that it is more likely that some school district employee accessing attendance records, for instance, for a legitimate reason, would inadvertently access other information. Paper files do not turn into a blank screen if the person reviewing them gets called away on an emergency and is not able to refile the paper in a timely manner. So while we appreciate the concern for privacy, and I'm not going to address any of the issues raised about the one-to-one devices and the access by the providers. For the student information system, we believe that there are some inherent drawbacks to the opt-in system rather than an opt-out system.
Thank you for your testimony. Is there anyone else in the audience wishing to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none, we'll move to member questions. Representative Rush.
I have a question.
That was from previous. Representative Smith.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. And to the testifier, nothing specific about your comments. I just wanted to thank you for coming down and testifying, representing one of the best school districts in the entire state.
An award-winning school district, I might add.
Yes. Indeed.
Very good. Other member questions. Representative Carlson.
Not a question, Madam Chair, just a comment.
Mm-hmm.
Representative Lucero, I applaud your work on this in protecting children's privacy data rights. I agree. It's very alarming to the number of breaches that have occurred both within the private sector as well as within the government sector, as you pointed out in your PowerPoint presentation. But I think for all of us that are here, I think it would be remiss to not point out the contrast between your presentation and what we heard with Representative Whalen's. I think we need to put this politics aside and start working for all Minnesotans to protect everybody's data privacy, because this is a common factor regardless of the group that we're trying to protect. We need to be mindful that there are significant concerns when it comes to data privacy. It's not usually a matter of if, but a matter of when those breaches may occur. So just wanted to draw that to everybody's attention. And again, if we can have this kind of approach, this kind of holistic approach towards protecting everyone's data privacy, I think we'd be best serving all Minnesotans. So thank you.
Any member questions regarding Representative Lucero's bill? Representative Lucero, so the bill distinguishes between the information that Ms. Weston was addressing, where it's student attendance records and their grades and those sorts of things. And is your bill saying that that information system should also be an opt-in?
Madam Chair, the intent of the bill is not to – it's to address the collection of information and then the sharing by third parties. That's in my opening comments. That's why I mentioned this. The bill is not intended to hamper the day-to-day operations of the school district and the ability to educate our children. That's not the intent of the bill, because it's understood that there is a need to collect attendance, to collect grades, etc. But it's the question of, after that's done and outside of the scope of the school district, where is that data going? Who is it being shared with? How is it being data mined? So you're absolutely right, Madam Chair. There is a distinction between data within the school for use of the school and by the school for purposes of educating children by district employees, etc., then versus that data outside of the control of the school district after it's been shared and so on.
All right. Thank you. And Ms. Weston, then, the information that you said it would be problematic to get an opt-in for being, the attendance, the grades, behavior, I think, issues you mentioned. Where does any of that information go other than within the school district?
Madam Chair, that information has to be forwarded to the Minnesota Department of Education for their compilations for statewide record keeping. So the school district gathers, for instance, behavior data. There's a code for each type of behavior, suspensions, that is transmitted to the Minnesota Department of Education for their uses.
Okay. And I don't know if you know the answer to this question, but does that information ever leave the Minnesota Department of Education?
Madam Chair, I am not aware of that information ever leaving the Department of Education other than in aggregate form. And there are reports about the numbers of expulsions per year, for instance.
Thank you. And so is there anyone here from the Minnesota Department of Education? Thank you, Ms. Weston. Good morning. Welcome to the committee. If you could state your name for the record.
Madam Chair, members, Kevin McHenry, Assistant Commissioner of the Department of Education. First and foremost, appreciate you bringing the bill forward, Representative Lucero. The discussion is very important. In terms of data that comes into the Minnesota Department of Education and data that is shared, Ms. Weston was correct. For the most part, all data is the personal identifiable identifiers are all stripped for public purposes. We do need to make sure that we are reporting how schools are performing. So we have a way of reporting on our website and to districts how each district is performing on their exams. If there are cell sizes of 10 or less than 10 for any student, we suppress any data. For any data that's used for research purposes, which are allowed under FERPA, that data would be shared under a data sharing agreement. The only time data that would be shared outside of MDE, it would have to be with the research institution. It would have to have a specific purpose as to why they would need to connect any personal identifiers. The research institution would have to have a way of protecting that student data, and the research institution would have to destroy that data after the research was conducted.
Thank you. And could you give me an example of maybe a time that that's been done, where there's been research done on Minnesota students' aggregate information?
Sure, Madam Chair. A recent example revolves the MCAs and college and career readiness indicator. A couple of years ago, in the Education Committee passed a bill where we had to develop a college and career readiness indicator. So, for example, if a student scored a specific score on the MCAs, if that was equivalent to a certain score on a college entrance exam, we did an alignment study to determine what that college and career readiness indicator score would be to align with a college entrance exam to enter into a state institution or college institution. Last year, the legislature did pass a bill where not only where that study that we provided for the college and career readiness indicator, we needed to go further in depth, so it required Minnesota State to actually do a study to determine if our scores were valid. The way that they determined our scores were valid is that they we had to enter into a data sharing agreement with Minnesota State, where they had to link data from students and how they performed on the MCAs in 11th grade with how they performed in their coursework in the first year of Minnesota State. What they did for that study was determine what students scored, did they have to do remedial coursework or not, and they came up with a specific score. So now if a student scores a specific score on the MCA reading or a specific score on the MCA math, they would not be required to do any remediation. So Minnesota State did that study. They to link that data, once they finished that study, that data was destroyed.
And did you have a way of following up to assure that that happened?
And Madam Chair, members, that's required under all of our data sharing agreements that we enter into. So yes, we did follow up with MinSCU after, or Minnesota State after that study was done, to ensure that they followed through with requirements of that data sharing agreement.
Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate that example. I think that gives members a clear idea of what might happen to that data if it leaves MDE. Representative Lucero?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I would just add one example to your exact question. I flip back to the MinLink slide. So you can see here from MDE, we have student academic records and student disciplinary records being submitted, which is personally identified, and that's being combined with, for example, incarceration records from the Department of Corrections. And so we can see a linking of that information. So the question becomes, did parents know that this is occurring? Should parents know that their students' data is being uploaded? And if one believes that they should know, that's the purpose of the opt-in, is to empower parents to put them back in as the decision makers versus government and business being the decision makers of where students' private information is being sent.
Other member questions? Representative Pugh.
Thank you, Madam Chair. No microphones.
Yeah.
I don't have a question. I just wanted to offer a comment, a note of appreciation to Representative Lucero for the amazing work that you've done to heighten all of our awareness about this subject matter. And I also wanted to express appreciation for how you've obviously worked collaboratively with the stakeholders on both sides of the aisle. This is not and should not be a partisan issue. Obviously, the whole focus is doing right by our kids and parents. So I really appreciate that. And I also wanted to take a moment and thank the great testifiers from the Minnesota Advocates and Champions for Children. Love the name of your organization, and just wanted to thank you for your excellent testimony as well for being here today.
Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for
thank you for bringing this up, Representative Lucero. And, you know, I hope that your presentation gives all of us pause, including in light of several matters, the Representative Whalen's bill, which is the last bill, but also just on the floor the other day where we thought that folks should hear evidence on seatbelts, and you've got in here on page 16 that you can't introduce this evidence in a proceeding. So the important thing about this committee, Madam Chair, is I like to think that in most cases we can try to be consistent with the politics. I mean, this place is a political place. There's no question about it. But I like to think that in this committee we can try to sift through some of that so we get to good policy that isn't driven primarily by our own subject matter politics when we get here, which is why I think, Representative Lucero, your bill here is really important. I think it does do that. We still have to have conversations about this, where we draw the lines, but it helps us to be consistent policy-wise, and we're not just falling on our swords for our favorite special interest group of the day, because at the end of the day, we end up having to fix those policies years later when we realize, oh, it seemed like a good idea at the time. But thank you for bringing us. I was happy to be a co-author on this bill in previous years, and hopefully we can move forward on a robust discussion of this. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Lesh. And you know what? There's a reason that there are different data classifications in statute, because different data has to be treated in different ways. And so I too appreciate Representative Lucero bringing this bill, and I hope that I see a lot of stakeholders in the room here, and if you haven't gotten in touch with Representative Lucero about the contents of this bill, I encourage you to do that over the interim, because we will be moving something forward hopefully next year on student data privacy. Representative Whalen?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just wanted to make a couple follow-up comments, because a few times now we've compared the bill that I presented to this bill, and I just would like to state for the record, we're not comparing apples to apples here. And if we're talking about consistency, when we look at the way we regulate education, teachers are licensed, for example. We have lots of regulations for our schools. We don't license abortion clinics. And so we want to be consistent in state law. Maybe we should look at licensing abortion clinics, and then we can re-examine all the reporting requirements we currently have on hand, which was one of the very few ways we as lawmakers in the state of Minnesota have to hold abortion clinics accountable. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee. Again, I appreciate the feedback, and I appreciate Representative Lesh, and there's multiple co-authors on both sides that are in this room and not in this room. And this is a very important issue, and I cannot speak highly enough of my partners and stakeholders from outside as well. And one other point I wanted to reiterate was I am obviously a technologist. That's what I've been doing for 15 years. But in addition to that, I'm a former educator. I taught college for 7 years. So as both a technologist, as an educator, I find both of those the topics extremely important. And so I'm not trying to, as I'm reiterating, the goal is not to hamper the ability to educate and use technology in the education context. Just the opposite. As a technologist, I want to get as much technology in there as possible. This is about the data. This is about who is in control. Should it be the parents and the students, or should it be the government and the business making those decisions? So, Madam Chair, that's what this addresses, and I look forward to working with the stakeholders over the interim and coming back next year so we can move this forward.
Thank you,
Madam Chair, and the members of the committee.
Thank you, Representative Lucero. And I don't think in past committees that we've had, even though I've said, oh, this is our last committee hearing. Sorry to keep getting you up. I wanted to thank our page, Ryan, and our nonpartisan staff, Ms. Mullen and Mr. Hopkins, and Laura from the DFL caucus, and Lauren from our caucus, my CLA, Nicole, and my CA, Callie. So with that, members, we are adjourned.